Welcome to the Ortho Eval Pal Podcast, where we can help you build confidence with your orthopedic evaluation and management skills.
Do you experience leg and foot fatigue when standing for long periods of time? A Maine doctor and the company he founded, Mainly Technology Group, have created a high-tech, all-terrain, chemical-free sock designed to reduce fatigue. The Easy Glider sock has a graduated compression weave to keep blood flowing and to keep you energized. Created by Dr. Lee Thibodeau, the Easy Glider is also frictionless, lightweight, warm, extremely durable, and wicks away moisture. The socks will stay fresh for days thanks to the organic antimicrobial agent Chitosan. Easy Glider is the only sock you'll ever need for sports, work, and leisure. Visit EasyGliderSocks.com.
We hope you enjoy the show. And now, for your host, Paul Marquis.
Hello and welcome to episode 52 of the Ortho Eval Pal podcast. I am your host, Paul Marquis, and today we're going to have a great interview today with Dr. Andrew Letterman from the Aroostook Medical Center. I'm stoked to have him here today. We've been working on lumbar spine evaluation podcasts lately, and we've got a lot of lumbar spine content coming. But it's important, I think, that you understand, you know, where to send patients when you're stuck with them. You know, there are so many treatments out there: physical therapy, occupational therapy. There's, interventional pain. There's acupuncture, dry needling. There's all kinds of stuff. So I thought I'd have Dr. Andrew Letterman on today and help talk about interventional pain management of the lumbar spine. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Letterman. Thanks for coming to the show.
Paul, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So Dr. Letterman, before we get started, I didn't get a chance to get a bio from you because we really put this together kind of last minute. And I'm wondering if you could give the audience a little rundown of your experience, you know, where you went to school and how you got from point A to point B.
Sure. So my medical career started right at the end of my college career, which was some time ago now. And once I decided I wanted to hang up my skates because I was a pretty serious hockey player in college, once I found that that part of my career was over and I wanted to move into medicine, I became a pre-med student after I graduated because I was a psych major in undergrad. After that, I went to medical school. I went to St. George's in the Caribbean, so I spent 2 years in classes there, and then my third and fourth years were spent in New York, doing all sorts of different rotations and different medical specialties. I then moved on to my residency. My residency was in a specialty called physical medicine and rehabilitation. And that's sort of a lesser known specialty. It essentially deals with any medical problem that results in pain or disability or some kind of impairment. And so that can range anywhere from a weekend warrior's knee pain all the way to spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury, and everything in between. And then in my fellowship training, my last year of training, I specialized in something called interventional pain in spine, right? I'm doing a lot of image-guided procedures for chronic pain from head to toe, but with a pretty intense focus on spinal pathology. So that's the sort of where my training led me. At TAMIC, my role is twofold. About 90, almost 95% of what I do is the interventional pain part, but a smaller part of what I do is also the physical medicine rehabilitation component, where I actually help run the acute rehabilitation unit, which is an inpatient hospital unit for patients who have suffered sort of a devastating medical problem, such as a stroke would probably be the most common indication, but traumatic hip fractures requiring surgery, spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, all sorts of different things. And they're just out of the immediate acute hospital period where they're deemed medically stable, but still have a lot of other medical comorbidities and obviously an impairment leading to a disability, precluding them from going home immediately. So we use that time to aggressively rehabilitate them with all our different therapy modalities of physical, occupational, and speech therapy. And I'm there in sort of a supervisory role, and obviously to watch over the medical aspect of things to make sure that's stable. So that's a smaller part of what I do, but it's also something I love. It stretches my brain in a way so that I'm not just seeing back pain 100 times a day. And so I like it for that reason as well.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. You know, so I've been working with you for a couple of years now, and one of the things that I really like about the training that you have is that you're such a good diagnostician, and it really is nice to have somebody to bounce ideas off and communicate with. And in earlier episodes, I talked about the importance of collaboration with people who are, you know, smarter than you and who do really good work, and that you can't do it all alone sometimes. So Dr. Letterman has been a great resource for me as far as, you know, helping to diagnose these really difficult lumbar spine issues. And, you know, we can talk all day long about interventional pain, but we're going to try to narrow this down to lumbar spine a little bit. Dr. Letterman, what are the most common lumbar spine issues that you see requiring interventional, you know, injections or pain management?
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for saying that. And I just want to say right back at you, because, you know, this is a group effort and it really takes a village. And when you're dealing with chronic pain, patients need a lot of resources, not just an injection. And so you guys at County PT have provided that for me as well. A lot of ideas, you know, we talk on a regular basis, and it's one of my favorite parts of the day to kind of nerd out and talk about musculoskeletal issues and differential diagnoses. So I love that. So thank you.
No problem.
In terms of the most common procedures I do, the most common thing I see or chief complaint in the clinic is typically low back pain. I'd say the two most common things that I do procedures for are arthritis of the small joints in the lumbar spine and also pinched nerves in the lumbar spine. And there can be crossover and they can certainly coexist. And that's the thing that makes diagnosing pain difficult and challenging, but also enjoyable, is that you often may be dealing with more than one diagnosis and may require multiple treatments, not just injections, to fully or comprehensively treat that pain. So as for the two most common procedures, treating arthritis of the small joints, also known as zygapophyseal or facet joints, there's really two ways to try to treat that through injection. This is all assuming people have exhausted a more conservative treatment regimen, such as some basic medications, such as anti-inflammatories, and typically a course of physical therapy to optimize the musculature that supports the spine. The injection for arthritis essentially would be to both numb and reduce the inflammation in those joints that we think are affected. Historically, that used to be done by injecting inside the joint itself, inside the facet. And once you're there, very much like a knee injection, which people tend to be more familiar with, you inject some numbing medicine and a type of steroid. The goal is to immediately numb the joint, which should provide some immediate relief within minutes of the injection. But then the steroid, which takes a little bit longer to act, is the part of the injection that we hope provides longer lasting relief. And I know we'll probably get into duration and what our expectations for these injections are, but that's the idea. The evidence actually showed quite some time ago that injecting directly inside the joint compared to another treatment regimen was actually inferior. And that other treatment regimen was actually to numb the nerve that goes to supply the innervation of that joint instead of directly entering that joint.
Okay, so
that's the nerve block. Now, a nerve block is typically only done with numbing medicine, which we know to only last, depending on which numbing medicine you use, several hours to 8 or 12 hours. Now, when I do that injection to numb the joint, I essentially numb several nerves to numb the joints that we think are affected. And I give the patients pain diaries to mark down their pain score before and after the injection. Now, if they get relief for the duration of the numbing medicine, or at least the duration that we know it to last, then we can make a conclusion that we're pretty sure the pain is coming from the joint that we numbed. And if they get temporary relief, like we would expect with that injection, we can do a second procedure in the hope to provide longer lasting relief. That procedure is called radiofrequency ablation. We're actually lesioning that nerve by applying a heat source to it with a special probe. It's the exact same target as with the original nerve block, but one final step to burn that nerve. Obviously, I would use a fair amount of numbing medicine so the patient's comfortable. But the idea of that is the exact same as the trial injection with the numbing medicine, but so it lasts much longer, in the order of 6 to 18 months. And that range is quite large. The reason for that is we're not actually transecting or cutting the nerve. We're just burning around the nerve. And so for that reason, the protective surrounding of the nerve and the nerve sheath stays intact. So the nerve has a capacity to regrow. And we think that happens at about a millimeter a day with some variability from person to person. And that's where the 6 to 18 months comes from.
Okay. I think one of the important things to realize from the perspective of a medical provider who sees a patient after they have an injection, for me, when I send a patient for an interventional injection, not only am I happy for the patient, you know, if they have some pain relief, but more importantly for me, it's diagnostic. So I always try to find out, you know, where was this injection given? What level was it at? Was it a facet type of injection? Was it a transforaminal injection? All of these can be very, very helpful. So we, you know, if a patient has a facet injection, they have some really good relief. I'm not going to press them into an extension program and agitate those facets anymore. We're going to work on a more pelvic neutral and maybe flexion biased program. So it helps to guide our care in physical therapy. And so for me, it's very important that we find out, you know, and we communicate about, you know, where those injections are and how long they last and whatnot. So that's important that we try to get that info.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really important. I mentioned, you know, that first injection with just the numbing medicine, and we consider that a diagnostic injection, meaning it not only is it an attempt to treating pain, but it really gives us a lot of information. So there's actually three outcomes to that injection. I mentioned one, if the patient gets very good relief of their back pain for the duration of the numbing medicine. Now, in some circumstances that thankfully actually aren't that rare, despite the fact that we use short-acting numbing medicine, patients will actually experience much longer-term relief. And this has happened not that infrequently. We can't explain exactly why that happens. There are lots of theories, but there's no real true understanding of why. But I typically explain to patients, if you're better, you're better. I'll take the win when I can. And in the case, in the event that that pain does come back, we could simply just repeat that block depending on how long they got, as opposed to the more aggressive approach of burning a nerve. And so that's the second possible outcome of the trial injection. The third possible outcome, still giving us a lot of information, would be if the patient got zero relief, not even for hours. And that tells me I'm quite certain I numb those nerves and therefore numb those joints, which tells me pain is not coming from those joints. So that's when we have to go back to our differential diagnosis, rule out arthritis of those joints, and consider the other things that we're entertaining as possible pain generators. And so that's the value of these diagnostic injections, is that not only are they an attempt at treating your pain, but they also allow us to hone in or at least exclude certain possibilities of the pain. And when I see a chronic pain of 20 years, it's often not one source. It's often multiple. So these injections help quite a lot at teasing out which pain generators are causing the most pain.
Yes, I totally agree with you. You know, chronic pain is a beast in itself, and I'll definitely be doing a podcast on how to manage chronic pain. One of the things that I wanted to mention is that, you know, oftentimes your patient will come to you, you might recommend a an injection, and the patient will say, you know what, that's just going to be a temporary thing. I don't want to have that done. That's just masking my pain. I hear this a lot. What the patients don't understand, and sometimes I try to put this into layman's terms, is that once you have an episode of back pain, and the Australians did an awesome job at identifying this, once you have an episode of back pain, you have significant shutdown, like a reflex inhibition of your transverse abdominis and multifidus muscles. And so if you are inflamed and having discomfort, you're not able to activate those stabilizing muscles of your spine very well. So I tell patients, you know, if you have the injection, it decreases your pain, decreases your inflammation, we can at least get you, you know, jump-started back into a transverse abdominis recontraction exercise program, start to work on pelvic neutral positioning. Once you start moving better, functional movement really helps to manage chronic pain more than anything, in my opinion. So I tell them that it is, you know, it's a stepping stone to getting from point A to point B, and can be extremely, extremely helpful, even if it is temporary. And so that's, you know, that's kind of how I approach patients who have questions about inflammation and the management with interventional injections.
Yeah, you know, I get that question all the time. And, you know, as a pain physician, I will be the first one to tell you the limitations and what I can do with a needle or a very small, minimally invasive procedure. And so, you know, the goal is not cure. That is not attainable. We are not that good at this specialty yet. You know, my goal is simply improvement, reduction of pain, improvement in function. And oftentimes, I would argue most of the time it's temporary, and we just have to decide how temporary it is. The goal, like you said, is really to reduce pain to allow them to work on the dynamic stability, which is muscles, as opposed to the passive stability of the spine, which is done with ligaments and bones. Only patients can work on that by exercising muscle. And so, you know, the goal of a lot of injections is, as you said, to bridge them to a point that they can perform therapy and work on the musculature in the spine that supports it, so the bones and the joints and the discs don't have to do as much loading. And so that is the idea, is really to bridge it. And I often say to patients, if I give you this injection and you get relief and you go home and sit on the couch and do nothing, it will definitely be temporary and likely more temporary. It will likely come back. And these injections over time, we know, work less and less the more of them you get. Yep. So that may be because it's a degenerative process. It may be because your body responds less to the injections, or both. Either way, if you do nothing with the relief, then you'll probably see a return to the pain.
Sure. I'm wondering if you could do something for me. We send people for interventional injections, and they'll often ask us, well, what does this entail? I'm wondering if you can take us step by step, you know, from the time the patient walks into the procedure room, you know, what is it you do? What kind of position do they get in? Are there certain precautions, things you ask before you get started? And can you talk to us basically from the time they walk into the time they walk out, what an injection would entail?
So there's a lot of work that's done behind the scenes by my staff to help coordinate these injections. I would probably start from the moment that I decide to perform an injection in the clinic. I essentially will explain to the patient, or do my best to explain, you know, what the injection entails, why we're doing it, what the benefits and risks are. And if the patient is in agreement, we'll go ahead and schedule it. We'll schedule it for a later date when we have the fluoroscopy machine or the live x-ray machine available to us. The day the patient comes in for that injection, depending on the type of injection, I'll usually ask them a few screening questions, that we have several level of checks to make sure, to ensure the safety of the patient doing these things. Often questions I will ask is, are they taking blood thinners or not? That's not necessarily important for all injections, but certainly for some injections, it's important. I'll ask them if they have any ongoing infections or if they're on any antibiotics, because after all, these are elective procedures. And if they're dealing with more critical, potentially life-threatening issues, I don't want to compromise them by adding steroid and impairing their immune system, if steroid is to be used. And those are the two main questions I ask about regarding their safety. And so once we're sure we're ready to go and we want to proceed, when we're dealing with lumbar spine injections, for the most part, patients will be lying on a flat table. In that room is a large x-ray machine that has the ability to rotate and move in all sorts of different directions. And the patient will be lying on their belly, and we try to make it as comfortable as possible. I also try to reduce the lumbar lordosis, or the curvature of their spine, just a little bit. When I'm doing one of the other most common injections that I do, which are epidural steroid injections, in that injection, you're really trying to access a space. And a lot of times it's a very small space. And so I do as much as I can to try and make the lumbar spine as close to a neutral position as possible. And to allow opening of the holes or the foramen or the spaces that I'm trying to access. And so we'll do that. And under the guidance of an x-ray machine, we'll be able to see all the bony landmarks of the spine. And so I rely on those bony landmarks to tell me where we think nerves and other muscles and different things exist. And obviously I would use numbing medicine first, and then we use a needle just to target wherever we're targeting. Most of the procedures that I do last no longer than 5 or 10 minutes. Patients usually tolerate it fairly well. Sometimes there is some discomfort, but oftentimes patients do well. I do not use anesthesia through an IV. Some pain physicians.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. Sorry, we had a little power surge. We lost power and got cut off. So we're going to try to continue on where we were. Dr. Lederman was talking about, positioning the patient and getting ready to do a lumbar spine injection. So I'm going to have Dr. Lederman take over from here.
Sure. So once we decided that it's safe to proceed with the injection, as I was saying, we position the patient on the procedure table. They would be typically lying on their belly for the purpose of a lumbar spine injection. And as I said, we do certain things to position them in the optimal place to allow for the ease of the injection and access to the target that we're targeting. Then once we do what's called a timeout, where it's the very last point where everyone makes the last checks to verify the patient's medications and allergies and the procedure and the proper side, then we proceed with the procedure. I put in some numbing medicine first, which I often describe as feeling like a pinch and a burn or a bee sting. And then after that, the patient should feel relatively comfortable. If at any point they complain of pain or discomfort with the injection, for the most part, I try to use more numbing medicine. There's some injections where I try to be more minimalist with that, so I can be sure the only thing I'm doing is just targeting the target that I want. Because like we were talking about before, a lot of times these injections are for the purpose of diagnosis. And if you numb too many things in the spine, from the skin to the muscle to the joint, you're taking away the scientific merit and diagnostic value of the injection. And so we're not going to be able to say if they get relief, did they get relief from numbing the joint? Or if I used a lot of numbing medicine, I also numbed the muscle and did a glorified trigger point. And I also numbed the skin. So maybe they had some kind of sensory issue and we numb that. So in certain injections, particularly the one for arthritis where I'm numbing just a very small branch of a nerve to numb a joint, I do try to be as minimalist as possible, but at the same time allowing for adequate comfort for the patient.
Great.
So once the injection's done, I'll let everybody know. We wrap things up pretty quickly. Patients, depending on what type of injection we're doing, there's different expectations as to how soon the relief should be expected, and we'll talk about that. And then the patient is on their way. So it's, for the most part, patients have a pretty good experience. There are needles in their spine. They are awake, and people have a healthy, adequate amount of fear about that, which is very understandable. So I really go a long ways in the clinic and during the procedures to do my best to put them at ease. We have a little bit of music going on in addition to all the numbing medicine to calm them down. So oftentimes most patients do fairly well.
So can people drive themselves home after a procedure, or do they need somebody there to bring them home?
Because for the majority of the procedures that I do, because I don't use sedation through the IV, it's typically quite safe for them to come on their own and leave on their own. In the rare event that I do use sedation, which I don't do very much at all, more for my advanced, more invasive procedures, in those cases, absolutely, I'll require that someone come with a driver and obviously leave with the driver. But for most of what I do, that's not necessary because we're not using sedation.
Okay, excellent. All right, that was a great first half of our show. I'd like to take a few moments just to get a word in from our sponsor, and we'll be back in just a few.
Did you know that over 90% of foot and ankle problems are caused by a tight calf muscle? Introducing the Easy Slant, a durable, adjustable, and portable calf stretching device. The Easy Slant was designed to increase stretching compliance and get you back on your feet and feeling better faster. So if you work with patients seeking to ease or avoid foot pain, or clients who want to improve their athletic performance, look no further. Visit easyslant.com to learn more or order yours today. Enter coupon code OEP for a 10% discount on your first Easy Slant.
Welcome back, and thanks for hanging out with us. And we have Dr. Letterman here with us this morning talking about interventional pain, and I'm so glad that everybody is staying with us. I think this is going to be a very, very helpful episode, and not only are we going to be able to help direct our patients better, but have a better understanding of what they go through when they undergo interventional pain. So Dr. Letterman, my next question to you is, how soon after an injection should a patient feel relief? Now, I know this can vary with everybody, but are there certain, you know, time frames that you tell a patient that, you know, they should feel a certain amount of relief after the injection?
Well, I would break it down into two different injections because the applications are different for each of them. When we're talking about the more common procedures, if we're talking about the temporary block to block the arthritis in the facet joints in the back, with that injection, I use a medication called Marcaine or Bupivacaine with 0.5% potency, or excuse me, 0.75% potency in the lumbar spine. It's quite a potent numbing medicine. The onset of action should be within 5 to 15 minutes, depending on how close to the nerve I get. Remember, I'm using bony landmarks to determine where these nerves are. I'm not directly visualizing it. So even though I rely on those landmarks, at times patients' anatomy varies. So for that reason, at times the medication may need time to spread to the affected nerve. So that's where the 5 to 15 minutes comes from. That medication is expected to last approximately 8 hours. And then it should wear off over time as the body absorbs it. With the other common procedure I do, an epidural steroid injection, now that's for a different type of problem where someone has a pinched nerve in their spine that may arise from a variety of reasons. In that injection, again, I do use a numbing medicine called Marcaine at slightly lesser potency, 0.25%. And I also use a steroid, a particulate steroid. That's actually somewhat of a debate in the pain world, what type of steroids to use. But in general, steroids don't act immediately. They take a couple days to really start working at all. I typically say between 1 to 2 days for their onset. They reach their peak efficacy at approximately 1 week. And the expectation is anywhere from 1 to 3 months with steroid. And that varies highly. Depending on severity of the problem and other factors. But that's sort of the range of onset and efficacy and duration of these medications that I've used.
All right. And so how long, I guess you've already answered the question about how long people can have relief with this. I mean, it's incredible to me sometimes, you know, I've treated patients who have like severe spinal stenosis. They're all bent over and we talk to them about, you know, relieving their pain. You know, oftentimes it's explaining the difference between a chemical irritation and a mechanical irritation. And oftentimes interventional pain will do a great job with, and even with oral medications to decrease that chemical irritant. But I've even had patients with significant mechanical irritation, you know, closed up, the facets are all arthritic and they have foramen that are completely closed up. And I always think, you know, there's no way people are going to get relief from interventional pain. But I had a gentleman I'd sent to you not too long ago and he came back to me and he was so happy. It was the first time in a long time that he'd had relief. And this guy was totally arthritic, totally stenotic, and it was really diagnostic and helpful. So it really, you know, can work wonders as far as keeping people on their feet and keeping them active. So that's great.
I just want to add one comment about that is you commented on the severity of their spine as it appeared on radiology. And that's one thing that I talk a lot about with patients, especially in the clinic, is, you know, one of the most famous studies that has been cited in the journal Spine, which is a surgical journal, was a study that was done on people who did not have back pain, who for some reason or another had advanced imaging of their lumbar spine, oftentimes with a CAT scan of their abdomen and pelvis, where you can actually visualize the bony spine quite well, which is something I use often when I don't have dedicated imaging, or they have an MRI. And so these are people without back pain, and we happen to get a glimpse into what their spines look like, what a non-painful spine looks like. And wouldn't you know it, as we age, almost everyone has degenerative disc disease and herniated nucleus pulposus or herniated discs and facet arthritis and lumbar spinal stenosis. And as we age, it almost becomes a guarantee that it's going to be there, and that's with no pain. So then it begs the question, what's the utility of these images? And the answer to that is really evaluating the patient's clinical status with a good history and a good physical is what you should start with. And when you link it to the imaging and when the imaging lines up with that, then that's great. Oftentimes it doesn't line up and you're faced with the decision, do I treat an image or do I treat a patient? And I always treat the patient. And it sounds corny, but it's a very important aspect because we've also dealt with a case where a patient had a herniated disc pinching a nerve on the wrong side. And the patient had other radiating leg pain on the other side. And that part of their spine was pristine, beautiful, and it didn't make sense. And so we chose to treat the patient together. And we ended up succeeding by identifying finally a target that we think was the likely cause. And that was a great example of just not relying on imaging all the time when things don't make sense. You really have to evaluate the patient and take their word because remember, pain is subjective by definition, meaning it's what the patient tells you. You can't see pain on imaging. So that's just a really important point. It also helps alleviate some anxiety with some patients. One of the big things that comes with chronic pain is patients just wonder, oh my gosh, I have this, I have this, I have degenerative disc everywhere. And I try not to roll my eyes sometimes, but I do try to explain to them that to take their imaging with a grain of salt because it often doesn't tell the story.
I am so glad you brought that up because really that just reinforces why I started OrthoEvalPal. It all came down to this burning desire to educate and teach people to do a better clinical exam, especially orthopedic evaluation. But as you know, there's a lot of carryover with neurologic stuff, such as nerve root impingement and that type of thing. And so, yeah, I'm really passionate about people taking their time and doing a good clinical exam and then making a decision if they need a diagnostic test rather than just hand out blanket referrals for MRIs and x-rays and CAT scans and, you know, and things like that. Like an x-ray, it's so important to do the right type of x-ray. You can't just do a standard x-ray for all lumbar spine issues. You know, I'm a big believer in the lateral view with a flexion and extension, you know, with the patient while they're standing and weight bearing in these functional positions. So I'm really glad that you talked about that because taking the time and being a good clinical evaluator sometimes will drive you in the much better direction. We can save the whole system a lot of money and decrease the excessive use of some of these diagnostic imaging procedures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and often a question that I ask myself almost always when I'm considering ordering diagnostic tests is this going to change my management? And oftentimes patient will come in requesting imaging and I have to go over that question with them and we have to decide together, is it truly going to change our management? For example, if they had an MRI showing a herniated disc a year ago and a pinched nerve, say their pain got better and now it's come back and it seems like a similar pain, and we have a pretty good idea of what's going on, are we necessarily going to repeat the MRI because their pain's slightly worse? Is it going to change our management or would we have just done an injection anyway? And if they were to get better and they got an MRI, then that MRI ended up being useless no matter what's on there. So right. Again, you know, the clinical status of the patient is the most important. And when you're considering a workup, that's one good question to ask as a clinician is this test going to change my management? Because oftentimes, especially in the chronic situation, unless a surgery is being entertained, or a major procedure, new imaging will unlikely change your course.
Right, right. Excellent. Thank you. How often can you give an injection? So let's say somebody has some pretty decent relief and maybe it was, you know, a month, month and a half. How often can you repeat that same injection to the same area if you know that that is really localized and that's the area you hit the target the first time, you want to hit that target again? How often can they have another injection?
Well, this question is an interesting one. We're getting into territory where there's quite a lot of mixed evidence and there's several different points to talk about. One of the more common points and one of the things I like to harp on is the steroid burden over the course of a calendar year. And, you know, there's often more than one provider who's doing injections. You know, lots of, certainly maybe only one person doing spinal injections, but there are other people doing knee injections and shoulder injections. And when we're dealing with steroids specifically, and not all injections necessarily deal with steroids, but when we are, we have to sort of take into account the total amount of steroids given in a year for these elective procedures, because too many steroids can be a problem. They can do certain things like elevate blood pressure, elevate blood sugars, increase the amount of fluid retention, which can strain your heart. They can increase the possibility of bleeding. They can increase the possibility of infection. They can reduce bone density and put people at risk for fractures. So, you know, we really get into a hairy area when you're dealing with people who are getting more than 5 or 6 steroid injections over the course of a year. And a lot of patients that I see do get that. So that's my general rule. There's no recommended rule as to how many steroid injections someone can get in a year. I like to keep it within 5 or 6 or less than that. Beyond that, I start to try to apply strategies not including steroids. And there definitely are strategies like that, different types of procedures that don't necessarily involve steroids. But that's one of the things that I consider. In terms of just in general, the number of procedures done, that comes down more to an issue of quality of life. Is if you need 10 or 12 injections in a year to manage your pain, that's going to be traumatic at some point. You know, that's a lot of injections. That's a lot of needles. That's not comfortable. And that's not a great way to live. So if you find yourself doing that, and thankfully I don't find myself doing that, if I reach a case that's that bad, usually the patient will have moved on to a different strategy. You know, I try to stay away from doing that many injections, but there's no hard and fast rule.
Right.
Just the ballpark. We shouldn't be beyond that.
Okay. I'm not saying this has ever happened to any of your patients. I've actually never seen this happen to any of your patients, but I have seen this happen where somebody goes in for a lumbar spine injection. They come out and, you know, maybe a day or two later, end up with these severe, severe headaches. Can you explain to us why that would happen? And number two, is there a management for that? I mean, do they have to just kind of live with this and kind of heal on their own, or is there some way to help kind of mitigate that?
Well, there's a couple different possibilities as to the underlying cause of those headaches. One of the causes is the steroids themselves. We talked about one of the potential side effects of elevating blood pressure, and certainly steroids themselves can result in all sorts of side effects, including headache. Another possibility for the underlying cause, especially after doing an epidural steroid injection, is something called a postdural puncture headache. Now, this is considered a minor complication. This is when the needle basically penetrates a particular area in the spine that results in the leaking of cerebrospinal fluid. Now, those things typically resolve on their own. They come with a very characteristic headache that's positional, meaning when you're lying down on your back, things are okay, but the second you try to sit up, you get a really pounding headache that's on both sides of your head and, again, resolves when you lie down. That's what we mean by positional. These types of headaches typically resolve over time. In rare cases, they don't. There are things that can be done before you do anything too invasive. Things that should be done for that specific type of headache, a postdural puncture headache, would be to lie down in a dark room, to stay very hydrated, and to drink things that contain caffeine, actually. A lot of other headache syndromes, that's the recommendation, but for postdural puncture headaches, that's certainly one of them. A more invasive treatment for a postdural puncture headache, if you're sure that's the cause, is something called an epidural blood patch. Now, that's actually a very similar injection to an epidural, but instead of injecting numbing medicine and steroid, you're actually injecting the patient's own blood, which is drawn from a sterile IV. And the theory behind how that works is it actually helps with the clotting factors that close up where the leak is. And that typically resolves the postdural puncture headaches within minutes of doing that injection. Again, it's another procedure, so you don't want it to be the first line treatment, but certainly in difficult refractory cases that can be done. In general, though, and by the way, these have all happened to me. I don't lie about complications. If you do lie, you're not doing enough procedures or you're lying. So, I've definitely had both of these at various times. Oftentimes I don't distinguish between the two because patients aren't coming in to be seen. They call and are complaining of a headache after. I try to come up with a differential diagnosis, and I have a plan set in place. But across the board, I typically advise to rest and lie down in a dark room. If they do take some pain medications at home, some simple ones such as a Tylenol or an ibuprofen or others they may have, I encourage them to take whichever one I think is appropriate. And again, hydrate and with caffeine. And then if that fails, an epidural blood patch. Now, I've only ever had to do two epidural blood patches in the thousands of injections that I've ever done. But it's certainly an option in those specific cases.
Yep. Excellent. Excellent. Now, I know we touched on this a while ago, but if somebody has, you know, like oftentimes patients are ready to have total knee replacements or total shoulder, total hip replacements, there's a lot more literature, I guess, now, and physicians are saying, well, we don't want to inject these folks, you know, within 3 months of having surgery. Now, is there a difference between injecting a knee before a knee replacement and injecting a spine before a knee replacement in regards to their risk of infection? Do you know the answer to that?
There's not as much literature in the spine surgery journals about proximity of an injection and risk of infection after, risk of infection after surgery. there is fairly good documentation, in part because these issues are more common when we're dealing with the peripheral joints, such as knees and hips. And surgeons don't like to enter a joint surgically if something else or a foreign body has been there in recent history. And because they really don't want complications, which is obviously understandable. And steroid, remember, not only did you introduce a foreign object being the needle, you introduce a steroid, and that's an anti-inflammatory, but also impairs your body's own immune response, and therefore could not fight an infection in the rare event that you did introduce some kind of bacteria or some kind of pathogen to the joint. So the 3 months comes from studies that have been done to show that medicine has essentially been cleared and absorbed, and your immune system is likely, you know, intact and not being affected there. The literature doesn't exist as much for the spine. I can't answer why that is. There is sometimes more urgency when you're dealing with compressed nerves to treat those things. And time is more important than worrying about what medicines have been injected, because oftentimes we talk about strokes and the saying time is brain, meaning the sooner you address something, the more likely it is to have a successful recovery or limit the damage. The same is true with nerve or peripheral nerves that might be pinched in the spine. Time is of the essence, and if it's deemed that a nerve needs to be decompressed, the sooner the better. And waiting 3 months, even though an epidural has been done, may not be the best move, even though there may be a slightly increased risk, even though there's no evidence for it, slightly increased risk of complications or infection.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, thank you. That's a great explanation. You know, we could talk all day about lumbar spine and injections, interventional, and maybe we look at other body parts with future episodes. But I want to, first of all, say thank you so much, Dr. Letterman, for taking your time. I know your time is very valuable and short. You're a very busy guy. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show and, help give a little education about what interventional pain is. I hope to be able to have you again in the future, maybe on another topic, similar in nature.
Oh, I'd absolutely love to be back. And thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure talking to you about musculoskeletal issues.
Great. Well, if any of you folks have any questions for myself or Dr. Letterman, make sure you get in touch with us on orthovalpal.com. Go to our Get in Touch page and you can shoot some questions over to me. I can forward that to Dr. Letterman. We can hopefully answer your questions. Or if you have maybe a topic that you'd like to hear about in the future, maybe we do an episode about it. As you know, we are right in the middle of our lumbar spine series right now. So make sure you go over to our YouTube channel and check out our playlist. I just recently did a video on each segment of the lumbar spine. So how to identify an L3, how to identify an L4 and L5, and even have a podcast for each one of those so we can really specifically look at what those signs and symptoms are. And I also have some real patients with real diagnoses that we have on the playlist. And so that would really help you apply, you know, what you're learning to some of these videos. And make sure you catch us on iTunes and shoot us a rating and review. That would be great. I'd really appreciate that. It really helps to let us know kind of what direction we're heading in. And as you know, if things are going as well as they have been the last month or two, things are just going to go upward. OrthoEvalPal has been doing great, and we've been having a great viewership lately, and I really appreciate all of you for listening and for all the feedback. So I hope you all have a great day, and until our next episode, take care.
We hope you've enjoyed the show. For some more awesome content, go to OrthoEvalPal.com.